Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Trump White House has a habit of issuing confusing and sometimes contradictory statements on many different topics. A couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump made some statements about autism and tied what he views as an alarming increase in the rate of autism to the use by pregnant mothers of acetaminophen, which is the active ingredient in Tylenol, and his views on various vaccinations given to young children. Trump made this announcement.
Effective immediately, the FDA will be notifying physicians that the use of acetaminophen, is that okay? Yes. Which is basically commonly known as Tylenol during pregnancy can be associated with a very increased risk of autism. So taking Tylenol is not good. All right, I'll say it. It's not good.
And when it comes to mothers with high fevers, he suggested that they simply tough it out.
With Tylenol, don't take it. Don't take it. And if you can't live, if your fever is so bad, you have to take one because there's no alternative to that. Sadly, first question, what can you take instead? It's actually, there's not an alternative to that. You know, the way I look at it, don't take it. Don't take it. There's no downside in not taking it.
But medical experts say that simply is not true. It isn't true. Worse, it isn't based on science. But that pronouncement, along with several others about vaccinations for babies and young children and his connecting them to autism, has people worried and the medical community pushing back. So today, a look at the science and at what it actually says and what, if any, connection any of this has to autism. Dr. Amelia Sutton is a maternal fetal medicine specialist and a medical geneticist in Charlotte, also an OBGYN. She's been on the program before. Welcome back. Dr. Jill Grayson is an adolescent and child psychiatrist with Jason Psychiatry. And LeBecky Rowe is a parent, an autism advocate, and executive director of Let's Talk About It, the Autism Center. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning.
It's radio.
Good morning.
You got to talk. I say it every day. You got to talk. It's real. So Donald Trump made several statements. We heard a few of them regarding what he and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Dr. Oz see as a tie between the rise in autism and the use of both Tylenol during pregnancy and vaccinations of children after birth. And I want to play pieces of this statement as we go through this first part of the program and get your reactions. Let us start with this.
The meteoric rise in autism is among the most alarming public health developments in history. There's never been anything like this.
Dr. Sutton, is that true?
So one thing is true is that we have seen an increase in diagnoses of autism, but that's largely due to increased awareness, better screening, and being able to categorize what we previously couldn't categorize as neuroatypia now into an actual diagnosis.
So that was going to be my next question. Is the rise right. Because the incidence is actually going up, or that we have the ability to diagnose it more accurately and spot it more accurately and have a greater understanding of the various aspects of autism that perhaps we didn't have before? And as a sidebar to that question, if you have the director of Health and Human Services in on this, shouldn't they know that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any qualified physician or scientist would understand the complexities of this rising incidence of autism. It's thought to up to 90% of autism is actually genetic, so it's not thought to be an increase in the actual incidence. It's just an increase in the diagnosis primarily.
So if you're running a federal agency and you're dealing with scientists and you're talking with scientists and you don't know that, is that because you're ignoring the science and trying to fit the science to your preconceived notions, or is it simply because you're out of the loop and they haven't been told? And if that's the case, why are you making this pronouncement? Help me understand this.
I think that is a very valid concern. It's difficult to obviously know why this hasn't been more, robustly explained to the public. The complexities of this issue, it can't be boiled down to a single cause or a single inciting factor whatsoever. So it's hard to know if we're cherry picking our science to fit a certain narrative. If that's the case, of course, that's quite alarming, and that does fit with the pattern of what this administration has been pushing on the public recently.
So LaBecky Rowe is with us. She is the director of Let's Talk About It, the Autism Center. She's also a parent of a child who was diagnosed in the 90s with autism. To reiterate, autism is not a disease, and it isn't just one disorder. It is a range of symptoms, the severity of which can vary. First of all, LaBecky, is that you're the expert here? Is that accurate? And how would you explain it to a parent whose child was just diagnosed with it?
Well, today the DSM-5 states that you have three levels of autism. We have the level one, we have the level two, and level three. And I find that parents are trying to figure out which level their kids are diagnosed on. But what I want parents to do is lean into the diagnosis and find resources to help you through the diagnosis. This is your journey. It's up to you to find the services that are available. And there are quite a bit of services available here in Charlotte, North Carolina, to help that parent to understand the diagnosis and know the steps that they need to take in order to help their child as well as their self.
And Dr. Grayson, the Mayo Clinic says that we once believed that the various disorders on the spectrum, on the autism spectrum, which would include autism and Asperger's syndrome and childhood disintegrative disorder and others, are all separate, but they're not considered to be separate now. We see them as part of that spectrum. Why does that matter that we see it differently now?
So they're all, it's a spectrum and they range. And like she said, the important thing is that it's not something to cure either. It is, it's not all bad, right? The heterogeneity of autism means that it's from like intellectual abilities and language abilities can range from impaired to well above average. So some of these, what we call, like sometimes we call them 2E, twice exceptional kids who have autism also have very high IQs. So it does range. Think that answered your question.
Well, how do you determine where on the spectrum a young person is, or an adult? Because some people are diagnosed with this in adulthood. They've gone through their entire adolescent and teen years, and they knew something was a little off, but they didn't know what it was, and now they find out as an adult. And I am told that that is particularly true of women over men. I think men find out sooner because they struggle differently than women do with this. But anyway, what was my question? My question was, how do we diagnose it? How do we determine where that person is?
So we're still changing all the evaluations because they are still based on the old ways. Like even the ADOS is based solely on boys, the data, which is like one of the gold standards. So that is part of the problem, is that girls present differently and are able to mask and look more neurotypical. But when they are on the spectrum, it's not just a spectrum level one, two, and three. They can be in different levels and different aspects as well.
And Dr. Sutton,
So
when,
they're,
go ahead.
go ahead. I was gonna say the intellectual functioning as opposed to like repetitive behaviors.
Okay, so what are the most common symptoms, Dr. Sutton? When should a parent become, when does a parent usually become concerned? What brings them to the doctor for a diagnosis, and at what age does that normally happen?
I think Dr. Grayson's probably better to answer that since she sees children
Okay.
primarily, and I focus more prenatally.
Dr. Grayson, go ahead.
I would say When they're younger, it's the communication difficulties, so a loss of language as well. So they could develop language and lose language. And that's when I'm saying like four and under. As they get older, it tends to be the emotional instability.
Lebecca, your son was diagnosed in the 90s with autism. And at the time, evidently, there weren't all that many different places or resources to turn to. How has that changed?
If I can add to the previous question, I want to say sometimes you may have that lack of eye contact or lack of social skills. You'll notice that when you take your kid to maybe a play date, that they are not socializing with the kid that they're there to play with, but they may be more engaged with the adult that's there. Hmm. And, you know, they may have the hand flapping, maybe rocking, or maybe echolalia, like repetitive talking about what they may have seen on TV and stuff like that. But as far as my son being diagnosed back in 1998, he was diagnosed at the age of three. And it's that we saw the lack of eye contact, the repetitive behaviors, the OCD, if I would say, like things had to be lined up a certain way. He could read billboards, and he knew how to go in the direction that we may have gone before, and just to tell us the way to go. But he was not able to converse with us. And the fact that he was academically, he was doing well as far as his writing and saying words on, you know, you research. I had to research, and it wasn't much research back then. Let's just be very clear. I did not have Google. I did not have ChatGPT. And I just had to find what they had available about autism. And it was dismal, right? But I knew that I had to do what I had to do to help my son. And I had to step in. I had to lean in and show him the way.
Are things better today for parents with newly diagnosed young people?
Absolutely. I mean, you have more than speech, because back then I just had a speech therapist and a neurologist. Those were my only two professionals. But today we have everything, especially like, right, we have ABA. We have community resources like myself who can help parents to navigate the diagnosis of autism. Because for me, I know what it felt like for me to get that diagnosis. You know, I felt like someone had kicked me in my gut. Like, who was going to help my family? Who was going to help him, just us as a whole, to navigate this new world that we're finding ourselves in?
And even though there may be more resources today, do we understand what's going on more fully, Dr. Sutton? Do we understand the medical background of what's happening in a person's, I guess, their brain? I guess that's where it starts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So now we really understand that this is likely largely genetic. Up to 90% of cases have some genetic component, and over 100 genes, likely more, have been identified that are associated with autism. And we know that siblings of people with autism have a 20% risk of being diagnosed with autism in their lifetime as well. So we're really starting to understand what the causes are. Are there environmental exposures? Yes, but this is largely a genetic disorder.
And that's why she's on the program, Dr. Amelia Sutton. She's a medical geneticist and a maternal and fetal medicine specialist and an OBGYN. She's here with Dr. Jill Grayson, an adolescent and child psychiatrist, and Lebecca Rowe, parent of a child with autism and the director of the Let's Talk About It Autism Center. We're going to come right back and talk some more about what the president said about this and its connection to vaccines and its connection to Tylenol, and the statistics that he spouted at that White House press conference a couple of weeks ago, and get an update on the accuracy of that when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about autism and the causes of it and the treatment for it and what it means to somebody who gets it and what it means to their Families with Dr. Amelia Sutton, an OBGYN and medical geneticist. Dr. Jill Grayson is a psychiatrist, and LeBecky Rowe is the director of Let's Talk About It, the Autism Center. A couple of weeks ago, the reason for this entire thing is that the president held a press conference with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Health and Human Services Secretary, and Dr. Oz, talking about autism. And at that press conference, Donald Trump went on to share some statistics. It can get confusing, so we will parse them after we hear them.
Just a few decades ago, 1 in 10,000 children had autism. So that's not a long time. And I've always heard, you know, they say a few, but I think it's a lot less time than that. It used to be 1 in 20,000, then 1 in 10,000. And I would say that's probably 18 years ago. And now it's 1 in 31. But in some areas, it's much worse than that, if you can believe it. 1 in 31. And I gave numbers yesterday. For boys, it's 1 in 12. I was told that's in California, where they have, for some reason, a more severe problem. But whether it's 1 in 12 or 1 in 31, can you imagine? That's down from 1 in 20,000, then 1 in 10,000. And now we're at the level of 1 in 12 in some cases for boys. 1 in 31 overall.
Okay. He also says that since 2000, 5 years ago, autism rates have surged by more than 400%. That was a lot of numbers delivered in a rambling manner with some opinions thrown in for good measure. But are the numbers even close to being accurate, Dr. Sutton, in terms to the rise of the incidence of autism?
So one thing that is correct in the statement is that we think about 1 in 31 children that have autism, and that represents about 3% of the population. You know, what were the rates previously? Quite low. And like I said before, this is primarily due to increased awareness, increased ability to diagnose, expansion of the diagnostic criteria, whereas people that were just thought to be had a little bit different have an actual name. And again, this is a neurodivergence, meaning this is just a difference. It's thought to be just a difference, and there's less and more severe, of course, rather than a disease itself. Whereas the numbers perhaps are along the same trajectory, it's not because autism itself is increasing. It's always been there.
Is it true that boys are more often affected with autism than girls, or does it simply present differently and perhaps more noticeably? And if so, why?
So I think Dr. Grayson might be better to answer that question, okay. But I'll pass that to her.
Go ahead, doctor.
For every girl identified, boys were nearly 4 times more likely to be diagnosed. Girls tend to mask more, which means they will mimic all the neurotypical behaviors. I think Becky mentioned the echolalia. They repeat like what you see on TV or normal conversations, which... So they try to fit in more. So girls tend to go undiagnosed. They also tend to have less behavioral problems. And same with ADHD. When you have less behavioral problems, you get noticed less.
And since this is neurological, is that because the actual physical makeup of a boy's brain is different than a girl's brain? Or do we understand it even? Do we understand what's going on?
I think we are not sure. I think Dr. Sutton said it's genetic, we're seeing it in siblings. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Medical Genetics also now recommends full genome or exome testing for anyone diagnosed with autism. And I can tell you personally, about half the people I test who come in do come up with an actual genetic variant linked.
So now we know that this is not just one thing. It's a combination of things, and the recipe, it can change individual to individual. You're somewhere on the spectrum, and it can be a lot of different things going on at the same time. So does that make it easier or more difficult to both diagnose and to treat? And for treatment, do you go to a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or do you go to a physician, a medical doctor? Although psychiatrists are medical doctors, do you go to medical doctors?
I think it makes it more difficult because there's more nuance to it. And it's like, I like to call it more of an art to it, because we do not know enough, and you are treating a bunch of different aspects, and different therapies are available now between occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy. Like Becky said, all of that's available now and it all can help. I think you just need a good team captain. So whoever your team captain can be, is who you should go to.
LaBecky, in your child's case in 1995, at the age of three, what were his symptoms? What led you to seek a doctor's advice?
I have to give credit to my mom, because I would say things to her like, he doesn't like to be hugged. He's lining things up in the order in which they go. And my mom said to me, well, you need to put him in school. Maybe he needs to go to a daycare rather than being there with you all day. And I did. And in putting him in daycare, I remember the teacher saying to me, your son can do the work, but he's not playing with the other kids. He might be looking at his hands. He was doing hand flapping. And while he was doing hand flapping at school, he was not doing that at home. And so I wonder if it was sensory overload and being in the classroom with a bunch of other students or, you know, folks that he didn't know. And then he didn't know how to engage.
Wow. Back to Trump's press conference for a moment on autism. He gave a reason for the rise in the numbers that we just heard him quoting, and he blamed it on pharmaceuticals and some common medical practices.
When you go from 20,000 to 10,000 and then you go to 12, you know there's something artificial. They're taking something. And by the way, I think I can say that there are certain groups of people that don't take vaccines and don't take any pills that have no autism.
Dr. Sutton, can you make that leap? Have scientists made that leap from acetaminophen, which is something he quoted later on, or childhood vaccinations, to autism? Can you make that leap?
So absolutely not. So with this being predominantly genetic and etiology, it's multifactorial what potential exposures may be, what we think of as another hit. So if you have a genetic predisposition for something, often an environmental exposure can actually lead to the condition. And it's way too complex to be able to pin it on one medication, one exposure. And, you know, as we can kind of get into as well, the link between autism and vaccines has been extensively debunked over the last several decades. So there isn't really any scientific evidence whatsoever that there is a link between those two.
Scientists and medical professionals worldwide reacted to this very similarly. One of them, Dr. Peter Bernstein, a member of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Clinical Consensus Committee, says, quote, these studies are looking for associations. They don't show causation. Others have said exactly the same thing, and that may be difficult for a layperson to understand. So can you explain what he means by that?
Absolutely. So you can see two things associated with each other, but that doesn't mean that one thing is actually leading to the other, because they may be independently associated with a third factor. So for example, you're more likely to drown after having an ice cream cone. Well, that's not because the ice cream is causing you to have a drowning. It's because you're more likely to do two things in the summer, eat ice cream and go swimming. And so you can see that statistical association between things, but that doesn't mean that they're actually one thing is causing the other thing. And so that's what we're seeing with this link between Tylenol and autism. First of all, it's a very weak link. It's only in a few studies, and it's been not shown in other studies. So there's a lot of inconsistency in the data. And when controlled for likely confounding variables, those are two things that are linked to both the exposure and the disease, then that association goes away, essentially.
There's a lot of distrust in science and scientists all of a sudden. There's a lot of naysayers who are saying what the scientists say is not true, and that goes for autism and its association, alleged association with the vaccines, which it does not have, and now Tylenol, which evidently it does not have, according to most scientists. The same is true of weather and climate change. Dr. Grayson, you're the psychiatrist here. What's going on? Why are people so distrustful of the science? Science, the scientific method, goes through hoops to disprove theories, and that's how we come up with the answers to our scientific questions. Why all of a sudden this distrust? What's happening psychologically here?
I think part of it, as was stated, you know, we've seen it previously with this administration too, just the way they're leading people. We're not, when you put mass knowledge out there that is not, you know, everyone will follow it, and it's not based in facts. But the science really does not show, you know, like correlation is not causation. So like Dr. Sutton said, you know, just pumpkin spice lattes cause the flu. Do they cause the flu? No, but do people get the flu during pumpkin spice latte season? Yes, you know.
So psychologically, explain this to me. Why would you prefer to believe a myth over fact?
Because it's mass, it's what the media is showing us, and it's people group together. It's very common, and everyone wants a reason for something as well. And unfortunately, you want something to blame, something to fix. Like we've said, there's multi-factors with autism. It's genetic, and there's different environmental factors that might turn it on or be different hits. So we don't really have a great answer in science, and he is giving a easy, clear answer.
That was my next point. People want easy answers to complicated questions, and because I think we've been conditioned to solve things in 24 minutes because we watch television, and all the cases are solved in 24 or 54 minutes, depending whether it's a 30-minute or an hour-long show. Some were upset with Donald Trump's prescription for pregnant women to just tough it out. If they have a high fever, don't take acetaminophen products. Don't do it, because he sees this causal link between that and autism. If there was scientific evidence supporting that as good advice, which there is not, but if there was, that would be one thing. But it wasn't based on science, and evidently there are few other over-the-counter medications that women can use while pregnant to deal with pain and fever relief. What should women do, Dr. Sutton, who have fevers, who are pregnant, who have headaches, who have other pain-related symptoms while they're pregnant? What should they do with regard to taking a pain reliever?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, I want to say that it's such a vulnerable time in a woman's life, and to hear this kind of rhetoric is really difficult. It's really difficult because you're thinking, oh, I'm feeling so guilty. What can I take that's not going to harm my baby? I want the best outcome as possible. So first of all, you know, taking advice from your own personal physician, because that's going to, a lot of factors go in to whether or not you take medication for any condition in pregnancy or not, because there's risks of not treating conditions that sometimes and often outweigh treatment of that condition with any theoretic risk of that medication. So we know that fevers are actually associated with poor outcomes in pregnancy, especially in the first trimester. There's an increased risk of birth defects. There's an increased risk of preterm labor, and then an increased risk with pain, untreated pain, of maternal anxiety, depression, and high blood pressure. Tylenol is really the safest option that we have available. Things like ibuprofen actually have far more risk, can cause problems with the baby's circulation and other issues later in pregnancy. So really, this is the one that we have. We don't have great alternatives for pain and fever.
And for people who have been frightened by this and who may be second guessing that advice, what would you say to them?
I'd say that, you know, go to your physician and really ask some probing questions. Ask them to go through the data with you. We took an oath to take care of our patients, and it's our job to actually look at the data and look at this objectively to try to make sure that we're providing the safest treatment for our patients. We don't have ulterior objectives that, you know, for some reason we're not getting kickbacks from the makers of Tylenol to say this. This is truly based on our assessment of the scientific literature as a whole.
Lebecca, you're dealing with a lot of parents who have a lot of questions and who are very worried about what's just happened in their personal lives. What are you hearing from parents concerned about Tylenol, about vaccinations?
You know, we all have our own thoughts when it comes to Tylenol and the vaccinations. But what I would say to parents is consider the data and the research. Do your own research, and if necessary, get a second opinion. Reach out to seek community and lived experience from others, and use discernment to determine what's best.
Let me stop you there, because I only have 30 seconds left in this segment, and I hear a lot of people saying, well, I've done my own research. Do people have the wherewithal to do their own research? Do they have the understanding about where to go to do that research? And when they do their own research, are they coming back with accurate answers?
And if they're not coming, if they're finding that they're not getting the answers that they want, again, like Dr. Sutton said, reach out to your physician and ask them, right? You have options, and use your options, whether it's other parents, whether it's doctors. Always get a second, third, and fourth opinion if you're unsure.
We have to stop there. We'll come back with more on this topic in a moment. We haven't gotten to vaccines, but we will. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about autism, the fact that there is no causal link between autism and vaccinations. There is no causal link between the use of Tylenol during pregnancy and autism, despite what you may have heard from the White House several weeks ago. Dr. Amelia Sutton is with us. She is a medical geneticist and a maternal and fetal medicine specialist, OBGYN. Dr. Jill Grayson's a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And Lebecca Rowe is a parent of a child with autism and also the director of Let's Talk About It, the Autism Center. You were talking just before the break, Lebecca, about going to your, if you have a diagnosis, going through what this means with your doctor, getting as much information as you can from your doctor, and then doing your own research. Do you have any tips about where parents can go who want to do their own research, where that research is going to be accurate and not some theory out there by somebody making it up or with an axe to grind?
Well, we can Google, and we can also look for articles.
Yeah, but Google can take you anywhere.
No, but we I understand, but we can also look for articles that have been written by doctors who have done the research on autism and what autism is and how to help our children. And again, you can seek community help, right? Seek those who may be experiencing what you are experiencing or may have experienced what you are experienced. Lived experience is what you need to hear from someone with lived experience. And your doctor is always your doctor, your therapist, whomever it is, they should be one of your resources.
One of the complaints by medical professionals about what came out of the White House a couple of weeks ago is that it wasn't based on science, that there's no scientific evidence. No scientific evidence was presented to substantiate their claims of a connection between vaccinations and Tylenol or acetaminophen. Donald Trump said that he knows that some groups of people have no incidences of autism, and he asked for confirmation of the veracity of that thought process from his Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Is that a correct statement, by the way?
There are some studies that suggest that, yeah, with the Amish, for example.
The Amish, yeah, virtually. I heard none. See, Bobby wants to be very careful with what he says, and he should, but I'm not so careful with what I say.
Perhaps the president of the United States should be careful with what he says. But that aside, Dr. Sutton, is it true that the Amish have no incidences of autism in their population? Or would it be more accurate to say that because they eschew modern medicine, we don't know?
No, they definitely have diagnoses of autism in their communities. And they still get vaccinated, in fact. The vaccination rate may be a bit lower, but they still have autism. They do not seek medical care at the same degree than their non-Amish counterparts. And so that may be why there may be a lower incidence in that community of autism. But that's not a correct statement to say there's absolutely zero cases of autism.
So back in April, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. vowed to identify the environmental toxin, that's a quote, that he says is to blame for autism, and that they would announce their findings very quickly. Was this recent announcement just a couple of weeks ago about Tylenol and vaccinations, was it the result of that quick study? Do you know, Dr. Sutton?
It does not appear to be. First of all, that's not typically how science works.
Right.
Science doesn't work on a deadline.
This was to be a 5-month study, and that if you do April, May, June, July, August, September, that's about the right timing on that. But truly, yes. Scientific studies take years. Even if you put the best scientists in the world on this, could you come up with an answer to the cause of autism in 5 months? And if it were possible, would those findings be released prior to peer review studies, which would take an additional amount of time?
Right. You are 100% correct in that. So this implies that perhaps scientists have not been working on this for decades when they have. And science doesn't work with these strict and tight deadlines. It's impossible, like you said, to be able to gather the data, analyze the data. Autism is something that's not usually diagnosed until after age 2. And so looking at exposure to diagnosis timeline is years and years and years. And to get enough patients for that would be many, many more years. And again, peer review is very important. And the reason peer review is important is that you need your peers that are just as specialized in that in that condition as you are to analyze the data that you are presenting in a paper and look at it critically to make sure that your conclusions match what your data are saying.
And let me bring up something that others may be thinking about but they haven't got the microphone, so they can't articulate it. And that is, look at what happened with COVID. We had this COVID breakout around the world, and within months we had a vaccine that protected us against it. Well, that happened in just months. And the truth is that the mRNA vaccine was being developed 4 years prior to this, and it was a happy coincidence that it was available to doctors. And now even that is being poo-pooed because it came to the market so quickly. So you can't win. Lebecki, in making the announcement, Robert Kennedy said, quote, autism destroys families. These are kids who will never pay taxes. They'll never hold a job. Give me your reaction to that.
Well, we know that that's not true. As Dr. Grayson stated, that we have kids who are on different levels of autism. Autism is a spectrum. And we know that we have the higher level individuals on the autism spectrum who are capable of going to graduating from high school, just as my son did, and attending college. And so we have those young people who are attending college, and they're doing very well in the field of their choice, and they are making it happen for themselves, and they're making their parents proud. Why? Because the parents put in the work. And when you put in the work to help your child can be successful at every step, along every step of the way, right? So it's up to us as parents to believe in our kids and know exactly what they're capable of and making it happen for our kids. We set the tone for our kids. We have kids who are on the autism spectrum who get to study abroad, right? Because they have worked to be successful along with their families and their tribe.
Dr. Grayson.
Some of these kids, especially, you know, they have their special interests, and if you nurture them, you know, the family, you know, nurtures that interest and let, you know, supports them through college. These are the kids that are going to be like curing cancer. You know, they're higher IQ. They're so focused. They're passionate about it. Like, you know, these are those kids.
As part of his 5-month program to find the environmental toxin that causes autism, let's just leave it at that. He has proposed, Robert Kennedy Jr. has proposed to collect data by necessity. That study, all studies collect data by necessity, but questions have arisen about how that data will be collected and how it will be stored in something called the Autism Registry. Dr. Grayson, is there any valid reason to worry about that? Have people you've worked with expressed any concerns about what happens to the data?
Yes. Most families with new diagnoses are asking for them not to be documented now in their medical chart.
Why?
They are afraid. They do not know what that will mean going forward if they're in a bank. They don't want their children being selected out for anything, given less opportunity, but they are not, multiple families are asking me not to put it in the record, not to put it in the school IEP, not to put it in anything documented.
Will that slow down research? Will that slow down finding the causes and perhaps a cure? You've said there isn't a cure, but maybe someday there might be a way to reverse it. Who knows? But will that slow it down? People,
yeah,
not,
I mean, less
allowing data.
Yes, it is. I think the fear is in this administration and the way we're seeing autism as something that is bad and needs a cure, is their fear. But we do need the research, and that is why, like, most of my families also are refusing genetics, even though that is what I'm supposed to be doing with a new diagnosis.
So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Has been a vaccine skeptic for years. There's no secret about that. And he is not alone. Vaccine skepticism is running rampant in some parts of the country, and that has worried public health officials because vaccination has virtually wiped out a lot of diseases that used to kill children. I just read in the paper this morning that incidences in North Carolina of whooping cough are up, something that can be prevented through a vaccine. So when you have leaders joining in with vaccine skeptics, I would guess that medical experts see this as a problem. And Donald Trump took the conversation in that direction during that press conference when he was critical of a practice that has become commonplace to give babies a hepatitis B vaccine shortly after birth and to combine vaccines for different diseases like MMR, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines into one shot. He suggested a different protocol.
I think when you go for the shot, you do it over a 5-time period. Take it over 5 times or 4 times, but you take it in smaller doses and you spread it out over a period of years. And they pump so much stuff into those beautiful little babies, it's a disgrace. I don't see it. I think it's very bad. They're pumping, it looks like they're pumping into a horse. You have a little child, little fragile child, and you get a vat of 80 different vaccines, I guess, 80 different blends, and they pump it in.
He thinks It's very bad. He doesn't see it. He is also not a scientist, nor is he a doctor. Again, Dr. Sutton, is there any connection between these vaccines and how or in what manner they are administered and to autism or any other childhood disorder?
Absolutely not. So this was all based on many years ago, a study that, as you are probably aware, has been completely debunked because the data were actually fabricated and it's been retracted. And fortunately, that myth has been perpetuated now for many, many years. And what we do know about vaccines is they absolutely save lives. It's one of the greatest inventions, medical advancements in our country, in our world, that saved many lives.
So with all this skepticism swirling around, I'm sure that you're an OBGYN. I'm sure you've had mothers and young fathers come to you and ask you questions about this vaccine protocol, which has now become standard in most of the Western world. Can you assuage their fears? How do you assuage their fears? Or do some of them simply walk away and say, I'm not participating in this?
Well, definitely a mixture, of course. I think, you know, approaching these questions with an open mind from both the physician standpoint and the patient standpoint is really important, and trying to meet them where they are to understand where they're getting their information from, and then presenting them with the data and how important it is to vaccinate not only during pregnancy, but your newborn to protect them from these completely preventable diseases.
LeBecky, you are the mother of a child who, if I've done the math correctly, he's in his 30s now, who was diagnosed at the age of 3 with autism. How is he today?
He's doing very well. Thank you for asking. He really has worked hard to be who he is today. And like I stated, like early on, you know, I saw what he was into, right? Music was his thing. And so I followed his lead, leading him into music. And music turned into him participating in a talent show, singing at his 5th grade graduation, being in musicals and plays, and be able to showcase who he is. Because our kids come with a personality as well, not just an autism diagnosis. It's who are you? And they showcase who they are in within the talents that they are given. And so his God-given talent was music. And he has really rocked out in the music world. And today, he currently volunteers at the library, shelving books.
Somebody has to do it. Thank God for it. We have about 2 minutes left. During his press conference, Donald Trump promoted what he said was a possible treatment for autism, leucovorin. This is a drug that has been commonly used to reduce the side effects of chemotherapy, and RFK Jr.'s FDA has announced plans to update its label on that drug to include uses for cerebral folate deficiency, which has been associated with some autism symptoms, evidently. Dr. Sutton, quickly, what is your take on that? Is there science to back this up?
We'll give that to Dr. Grayson. That's
okay,
her specialty.
Dr. Grayson, go ahead quickly because we're running out of time.
There is. So we've known for a while, since like back in 2005, JAMA had articles on cerebral folate deficiency and neurodevelopmental disorders. But again, you have to have the autoantibodies for it to work. So I have a few kids on it who parents are now afraid that they're not going to be able to get it because it's going to be blanketed for everyone. It's not a cure-all. It's for kids who have the folate receptor autoantibodies.
So, LeBecky, since you have the child with autism and you deal with so many parents who are going through what you went through as a young parent, finish this sentence for me. A diagnosis of autism means?
It just means a diagnosis of autism. You should still have hope that your child can be successful in this world with all the resources that we have available to us.
And if anybody had any guidance for parents right now in light of what we've been talking about with the White House, what would you say to them, Dr. Sutton? I have 20 seconds.
I'd say seek care with your personal physician to get the best recommendations for care of you and your children.
Dr. Amelia Sutton is an OBGYN, a medical geneticist and a specialist in fetal medicine. Dr. Jill Grayson's with us also, adolescent and child psychiatrist with the Grayson Psychiatry, and Lebecky Rowe is a parent with a child with autism, an advocate for autistic children, and director of the Let's Talk About It Autism Center. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.